This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. When you think of long-ago war correspondents, you might think of Ernie Pyle or Edward R. Murrow. And now you probably think of men. But there were women covering World War I and the wars that came after. Joining me to talk about them is the author of the book Reporting Under Fire, 16 Daring Women War Correspondents and Photojournalists. The author is here today, Carrie Logan. Say your last name again.
Hollihan.
And we'd like to hear from you, too. You can call in at 513-419-7100 or email us at talk at wvxu.org. You also can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Marianne.
It's a pleasure to have you here today.
It's exciting for me to be here, too. I've been listening to you for a long, long time.
Oh, well, thank you. Let's talk about the book and why you decided to write it. Where did the idea come from?
Well, I'd have to say the idea was partially mine and partially that of my publisher, Chicago Review Press. I've written four other books for a younger audience, middle grade kids, that are kind of museum books, heavy duty on content with activities that are hands-on and themed to the people that I write about. But the publisher decided to go on a new foray and into YA or young adult publishing, which would be for teens, like, say, 12 and up, eighth grade and up, and they entitled this the Women of Action series. I have a background in journalism, and they knew that, and they've had several books out on intrepid women heroes of World War I and World War II, and we decided that a book on women war correspondents and photojournalists would be a good fit for them and something that I would like to write.
We should let people know you are from Blue Ash.
I am.
You're local.
Yeah.
So when you decided that you wanted to write that, how did you even begin to start? How did you know that these women existed?
It's interesting. The web, of course, is just a wonderful resource and something we didn't have even 20 years ago. So I probably did a lot of reading at the web, and then I hit my very favorite source, the Cincinnati Public Library, because if you start reading about the odd woman here or there, almost certainly you can find a biography about her, if not an actual book about her or by her, that you can, you know, go and sit and read. And I tend to, with the 16 different women, with each one, I sit and I read and I read and I read until I feel as if I have a pretty good grasp about her life and her work and what I want to focus on for a young person who's probably going to be reading about that journalist for the first time.
Well, let's talk about the audience. I think that's kind of an interesting angle on it. When you hear about these things, women, young women that are reading these books, maybe just don't have any interest or don't have any knowledge about it. How did you decide how to write it so it would be of interest to young adults?
I wrote each chapter as though it were a profile. With a background in journalism myself, I've learned that you can write a rather short but interesting narrative that has a story arc in it that is as much of interest to a lot of people as a fiction book would be. People are famous because they have a story arc, and it's my job to tap into that story arc and then to put that on paper. You write pretty carefully, pretty closely. It's nice writing for teens because, as I say, you can use compound complex sentences. That's all good. And so on. But again, your material isn't nearly as dense or in depth as it would be as if you were writing for a scholarly audience or an adult audience. You know, Doris Kearns Goodwin does her thing with a much thicker book. I do try to do the kind of the same idea with a much shorter framework to kind of pique the interest of young people. And then if they want to go on and read about someone else in the more scholarly titles or the quote unquote adult titles, that's where they can go.
As you were working on your research, which one of these women jumped out at you first?
Oh, every single one of them did in one aspect or another. I was intrigued by one named Eileen Corbally Kuhn. She was a reporter in China in the 1920s, whose husband was probably poisoned, they don't know for sure, when she was on home leave with her little girl. And she stayed in journalism her entire life, but covered both China after World War I and then was back in the Pacific covering World War II. She was just a really interesting character to me. And I found a little crazy thing about her on a Library of Congress website. They had on one of their blogs a book that was probably signed by her when she was a child growing up in Greenwich Village. And again, with the internet, you know, I made that connection and there she was. And she intrigued me a lot. Another one that intrigued me was Sigrid Schultz, who has a bit part in the book by Eric Larson, In the Garden of Beasts. She was a reporter in Berlin who was one of the first reporters, she and Dorothy Thompson, to sound off loudly about the Nazi menace and what was coming in Germany in the 1930s. She was a very cool subject to study, and I enjoyed learning a lot about her.
Did you find that as you were doing your research, did the women, did everybody take their work credibly? Did they have to fight to get their work read well and respected as men did?
Oh, absolutely. From day one. First of all, women weren't even, it was unthinkable for a woman to be a war correspondent. And the very first subject in my book, Peggy Hall had to fight tooth and nail to even get to France and to Europe to do what she did. It was assumed well into, I would say, almost the 1960s, well into the 1960s, that women simply couldn't do this kind of work as well as a man could. It was the city editors and the people sitting at home while they were out in the field pretty much decided that any stories they would generate would be from the, quote, women's angle. And in fact, up to about 1940, they were still called girl reporters, which seems unthinkable now. But when you consider that there was a lawsuit with the New York Times in the 1960s and 1970s on behalf of their women staff, it seems to be kind of a pretty natural thing or a pretty expected thing.
With Peggy Hall, it seemed like she sort of got into things a little differently. I think she's the one, correct me if I'm wrong, who was sort of writing ads and making them stories.
Yes, writing ads and making them stories. That's what she did. The perfect women's angle. You know, I did this, I did thus so. And by the way, I was wearing this dress from this downtown Cleveland department store, and I'm going to go buy my R&E uniform at this other store in Cleveland, and be sure you shop there too. But she was good enough to have a little disclaimer at the bottom that she was writing ad copy and not just straight stories.
But she sort of weaved it all together. I mean,
I don't think
you could really do that today.
Yeah, she did. No. Editors and, well, of course, look at newspapers. You know, we hardly sell advertising in newspapers anymore, but editors got a little more savvy, and I think people got a little bit wiser to what they were reading.
As I was reading the book, a number of the women, it seemed like they were doing their work and they weren't necessarily respected by the people that the journalists that they were working with, the male journalists, yet back home, the paper seemed to like what they were doing or they wanted them to succeed. Did you find that sometimes the publishers or the editors back home would come through for them to support
them? I think
maybe
the publishers had a little bit more enlightened view, although sometimes when they would cross certain publishers politically, that was the end of their career with a particular newspaper. Certainly one-on-one in the field, they had to really struggle, but not in every case. There was a Chicago Tribune editor named Floyd Gibbons, who happened to have lost an eye during World War I himself when he was in the field reporting. And he was very, very positive about the young women whom he mentored there in the Paris offices of the Chicago Tribune. You know, he would send them places and expect good work from them and promoted them and believed in them. There were a few people like that. There were Georgiane Geyer, who is still writing today and is a columnist, had the faith of her editors at the Chicago Daily News back in the 1970s when she went to Central America and went through some pretty hair-raising experiences down there in the effort to bring her story to her readers.
Our phone number, if you have a question or a comment today, is 513-419-7100. I'm talking with Carrie Logan Holohan. She is the author of Reporting Under Fire, 16 Daring Women, War Correspondents, and Photojournalists. Again, our number is 513-419-7100. You can email questions to talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Mary Kay has emailed and said she'd like to hear some of your favorite stories from the book. So what are your favorite stories?
Oh, gosh, I've got to think quickly. Well, I mentioned the one about Sigrid Schultz. She actually gave Hermann Göring an engagement party. And during the course of the engagement party, she whispered to him that she knew exactly what he was up to. And he, in revenge for that, I believe it was he or else it was Joseph Goebbels, referred to her as the dragon from Chicago. And and that stuck with her whole life. I admired the work of Martha Gellhorn. She was married to a gentleman who she referred to as UC, the unwilling companion, who, of course, was her husband, Ernest Hemingway. They went off to China together to find out what the story was in the 1930s. This was between the time that Martha became Hemingway's both lover and protege during the Spanish Civil War. They married and went off to China to find out what the story was there, and she had a thoroughly physically miserable experience, and Ernest, who loved to hold court in bars and so on, would send her on her way and on airplanes across the mountains of China to Burma and so on for her to cover her story. But sooner or later, she would return to Ernest and ended up being cheated on by him both with another woman and by the fact that he took her place at Collier's Magazine and got a free trip to D-Day, whereas she had to find her way over on a ship.
Well, that was interesting, too. As I was reading the book, it seemed like a lot of these women were not sanctioned. They couldn't get credentialed, yet they would sometimes beat the army to the places they were covering.
They did. Well, I think Marguerite Higgins actually snagged a ride on a jeep and was one of the first reporters into Buchenwald just after it was liberated. Of course, the horrible concentration camp in Germany. She was in there rather quickly, as was the very well-known photojournalist Margaret Bourke White, who both, quote, as we say, bore witness to what was going on in those camps right at the end of World War II. Martha Gellhorn also found her way over to France. She actually landed in France. She actually had the last word on Ernest Hemingway. He only got to report on D-Day from a ship. She actually got on shore in France and was somewhere in a hospital over there when she was discovered and duly sent back to England because she didn't have the right credentials.
How did they stay safe?
I can't say that they really did stay safe. They put themselves out there. Peggy Hall, back to our first profilee, actually marched on bivouac with Pershing's army, who was chasing Pancho Villa along the Mexican border right before World War I happened. She slept on the ground in a tent right next to all the soldiers, was certainly, you know, fell into a cactus at one point, was bloody, dusty, tired. Of course, several women were actually killed in combat. This has been happening, you know, very recently, and have been assaulted as well. Laura Logan of CBS being the one that's probably the best known. Dorothy Thompson, who was known to wear her dinner gown and dress fancy slippers out to war zones, was thought to be dead because reporters didn't hear from her for several days, and her obituary was even filed with the Chicago Tribune when, lo and behold, she showed up. So they weren't safe. Marguerite Higgins was in the thick of battle in the Korean War through, I think, four different retreats with the U.S. Army. She was embedded long before that term came into the popular jargon. She was embedded with the U.S. Army, as were several women very early on.
Did they have to? Well, you mentioned that the embedding, and that was an unusual, certainly for anybody, let alone a female journalist at the time. How did the soldiers and the military react to her? I mean, were they willing to?
Marguerite Higgins was actually hunted down and brought out first on a train and then on a ship by a general who was absolutely going to have no part of having any woman on site in Korea because there were, quote, no facilities for ladies. And Maggie Higgins, who was a very saucy woman, said that was okay. They were not lacking for any sort of bushes in Korea. I had a conversation with ABC's Martha Raddatz about the same thing. And she said, of course, these days people are much more enlightened. But she said if she had to step behind a tank, she would just give everybody a bit of a warning and that would be fine. So
you mentioned Martha Raddatz, and she's one of the more modern journalists in the book. What do you think her career is like compared to the women that you were talking about from World War One?
I think it's more accepted for Martha Raddatz to be accepted both by generals, by other news people, by the general public, as a legitimate reporter. The fact that she's a woman is kind of secondary to the issue. I like her a lot. It was interesting to talk with her. It's been interesting to watch her cover all these different aspects of reporting, to understand that, you know, she's balancing having children, although they're grown up now, with the demands of sitting in an airport floor with two different BlackBerries going off and things going on and being able to do that job the way she does it.
Well, that is interesting because she has children. She's been married. These other women, some of them were married, as you mentioned, the wife of Ernest Hemingway, but some of them just couldn't didn't seem to stay married. They seemed to find men.
They did. Some of them, I won't say that any of them was lacking for any male attention in their lives, but some of them knew who they really were as human beings and knew that marriage was not for them. Sometimes the right guy didn't come along. Sometimes the right guy did come along, but when a woman thought about what she really wanted out of life and out of her career and what she was going to be loyal and faithful to, it turned out that her work as a journalist and as a reporter trumped the idea of her being married and possibly having a family. You really can't speak. You know, everybody has her road to hoe, her journey to discover, or his journey to discover. And that's one of the things I really point out in the book is that each one of these women is the authentic thing, the real deal. Each one was true to herself, knew what she wanted out of life, and went for it.
I'm talking with the author of Reporting Under Fire, 16 Daring Women War Correspondents and Photojournalists, Carrie Logan Holohan. One of the, I should say again, our phone number, if you have a question or a comment, is 513-419-7100. Email us, talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Some of the stories that the, and I get all the women a little confused reading the book, but.
Me too. It's been a while since I wrote it.
But the idea of the humanness of stories. I know one of the correspondents went and was writing all these stories about what people were thinking in the country she was in and all those sorts of things. And the other correspondents weren't, and their editors and publishers were saying, why aren't you sending us these stories? Do you think they provided a different way to report on a war?
They certainly did early on. Because they weren't allowed in the field, because they weren't allowed right at the front line or in combat zones, many of them had to either get with civilians and find out what the impact of the war was on civilians, or get with soldiers who were maybe not right in the trenches, but were doing laundry or away from work for a few days or away from the trenches, and talk about their stories too. The human interest, it was really about the human interest aspect that a lot of these reporters used to get their first toehold into reporting. And as it turns out, these human interest stories, feature stories, you might say, turned out to be wildly popular with the people back home.
Were you able to get everybody in the book that you wanted? Were there others that you had to exclude just because you were running out of space?
Oh, gosh. Well, any number of current correspondents who are all the working correspondents now for all the networks and for PBS. Margaret Warner would have been fun to talk about. Ann Garrels, Clementine Hunter. I did also really work mostly with women who were at least born in the United States, although some of them now have citizenship with other countries, because there's many, many. There's a woman named Nancy Youssef, who's I follow on Twitter, who's an Egyptian reporter, and I'm not sure for what agency. Lots and lots of European reporters, obviously. And there were a whole slew of women who reported in Vietnam. And in fact, I named them all in here. There were probably a dozen women who I name, all who wrote books or wrote at least segments of a book about their experiences during the Vietnam years. They were all really interesting.
What about, you chose Martha Raddus as one of the modern journalists. Why did you pick her?
Well, I picked her partly because I was watching a lot of ABC at the time, and partly because she just struck me as the genuine thing. She doesn't strike me as being pretentious. She just strikes me as being solid. I don't think she has a particular axe to grind, you might say. I thought her reporting was pretty all-encompassing, global, not one-sided at all. And I really wanted to go for someone who struck me as being kind of, she could have been the girl next door, but she's, you know, jumping out of helicopters and reporting from war zones and also maintaining a persona with her family.
Was
in the U.S.
Was it easier to write that part since you had access to her as opposed to just reading
about
her?
It's much easier to write about those who have passed than those who are living.
Really?
Number one, you have to track them down. Number two, they're all so busy that if Martha had a half an hour to talk to me, that's all. We literally like set this up by email one day. She said, I'm free between 11 and 1130. Let's talk. Janine DiGiovanni, I had to contact. She lives in France. It was a lot of Skyping, a lot of telephoning and whatnot. Some people prefer to be more unreachable. Georgie Ann Geyer, you know, wrote a wonderful autobiography about her early years as a reporter and was very lovely to work with when I had to get photographs and things. She's almost 80 years old now, so and still working, generating those columns 3 days a week. So she was great, too.
Wow. But it is hard to get a hold of them. I can see that.
Yeah.
Vicky's calling from Lawrenceburg. Hi, Vicky. What's your question?
Hi. When I was a child, I read an autobiography of a woman war correspondent. It was titled, What's a Woman Doing Here? and I think her name was Dickie something. Was she one of the reporters you studied?
Would this have been Dickie Chappelle?
It would.
Yes. Actually, I don't write about her, but I have a very compelling photograph of her in the book of when she was killed in Vietnam. A soldier ahead of her in line as she was marching with the Marines through a minefield in Vietnam stepped on a mine. He wasn't killed, but she was. And there's a very, very compelling photograph by a Vietnamese journalist named Henri Uy, who was a Vietnamese journalist. There's a really compelling photograph of her being given last rites by an army chaplain there on the scene. You can see her helmet's off. You can see the pearl earring in her ear. And I went to the Associated Press, and for a not-so-small price, they agreed that I could run that image in my book. And it's such an important image that I decided to put it in. So, yes, it was Dickie Chappelle. And actually, if you want to look up more about her, I think if you go to the website of the Wisconsin Historical Society, you might be able to find quite a bit more about her that possibly wasn't in that book.
Great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for your call, Vicki. Our phone number is 513-419-7100 if you have a question or a comment. What are you going to write next?
Right now, I'm working on a similar book, Profiles of Young People Who Found Themselves in World War I. For one reason or another. Now, this has been a tough sell. I have an agent, and we took the idea to all kinds of places in New York and some other publishing houses across the country, and it just wasn't a sale for them. But I'm very grateful that Chicago Review Press actually picked up the book, and it'll be coming out, I hope, about a year from this winter. There's a lot of crossover because, obviously, some of the reporters I'm working on, I mentioned the Floyd Gibbons, who lost an eye. Well, I decided to profile him in this book about World War I. I get to write about guys, too, as well as women, so that's kind of fun. I'm looking forward to that. And I'm also doing some people who are household names, all of the Roosevelts, Teddy Roosevelt's family, a young comedian who left vaudeville named Buster Keaton to go be on stage for the soldiers in France, a young man named Eric Maria Remarque, who wrote a book called All Quiet on the Western Front, which I think a lot of kids have to read in high school these days, a young woman who worked with her mother doing x-rays on the front. Their names were Marie and Irene Curie. Another guy who wrote, who was kind of old, he was a captain and he was in his early 30s, and he was writing letters home to his beloved Bess, whom he missed so much. His name was Harry Truman. There's several other people, a guy named Fred Libby, who was a cowboy who became an ace pilot for the Brits. A woman named Catherine Stinson Otero, who was one of the best aviators around and who was not allowed to fly. Ernest Hemingway, who before he became Ernest Hemingway, went to Italy as an ambulance driver for the Red Cross, and several others.
Wow, so
it's a lot of fun.
There's a lot of information there.
It is. In fact, I was talking on the phone to an elderly gentleman the other day about Catherine Otero, who was his stepmother-in-law. Turns out that this guy also was on the West Virginia when it sank, and he'd been served breakfast that morning by a black steward named Dobie Miller, who went on to shoot an anti-aircraft gun and was decorated.
My goodness. Well, we'll look forward to that one coming out.
Thanks
so much for being here.
It's been lovely speaking with you.
My guest has been the author of the book Reporting Under Fire, 16 Daring Women War Correspondents and Photojournalists, Carrie Logan Hollihan. Producer for today's program was Pete Reitmeier. Today's technical director was Bruce Ellis. Our engineering staff, Don Danko, Bill Dean, and Mike McInish, helped today from Kevin Reynolds and Jim Nolan.